Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.
Coach Kelly, you are awesome. I listened to the last couple of shows, and you know, I had such excitement for just how talented you are, and then I felt sad, like I could be so easily replaced.
Oh, stop it. I missed you so much. That's what I was going to say. Like, I wanted to scream, like, you're back just now. We really missed you. So can you tell us a little bit the highlights of your trip?
Oh, my gosh. Well, Alaska.
So yes.
I don't know how much I can say without people. If you just have to be there to experience it. It was just so unbelievably awesome. You know, the word awe, like in being in awe. There were so many beautiful things. But the sad and tragic part is I actually got influenza A, not that 24-hour flu that people talk about. Oh, I felt like crap. I literally ended up with influenza A and was quarantined in the cabin. Oh, poor Christopher had to be quarantined with me, even though he wasn't sick.
Did he ever get sick?
No. Just in fear, though, that he might get sick. So they put him on this antiviral pack, the same thing I was on. But you know what? We had a nice window, so I got to see a lot of those 2 days.
Oh, my God.
But the highlight of the trip, even though I was really sick, is I pulled it together and we took a seaplane and we went out to this place called Neats Island.
Okay.
And there was only 11 people who live on this island.
Oh, my
and
God.
As we're pulling in with the seaplane, you could see the bears all over. A mama bear with her cubs and some other old bears. They call them the old timer, the 16-year-old old timer. And then we got to go by the Salmon Creek, the Salmon River. Watch the bears actually pull the salmon out and have sushi.
This is incredible.
I know. It was incredible.
So did you actually land on the island and could walk around? Or was this just
wow? We could land on the island, and then we did about, it was like a 45-minute walk internally and into where the river was and stuff, and it was pretty amazing.
That is a highlight. Good for you. You're such a trooper. Like, only you with influenza A would be like, all right, I'll just hop on a little, plane that's already going to make me nauseous and I'm already sick, but I'll go ahead and do it.
Thank goodness for the anti-nausea medication. Oh. That's the only way that I was able to do that. It was, I felt a little bit more compassion for you too with the whole, with your kids vomiting all the time. I mean, it's like, oh my God, poor Kelly. She has to deal with this with her munchkins on a regular basis.
Oh, but no, but it's worse when you're an adult. I think it hits you harder. It's like you're worn out. I feel like kids are a little more resilient.
Yeah. I hadn't had a fever. I had 103 fever, about 102 and a half, 103. I have not had a fever that high since I was a child.
Yeah.
Most adults, you don't usually get fevers quite that high. We can actually talk to our pediatrician who's going to be on with us in a short while about some of these things too, but I want to hear about your exciting, you said you had a girls retreat.
So I had a little girl, it was a girlfriend of mine, and I don't know, I just emailed her about, a month ago. I was like, I just need more fun in my life. Do you want to go away for one night? She's got two kids also. She's like, yeah, let's do it. So we went to Terranea. I think I'm pronouncing it right. It's Palos Verdes. It's like a little resort where you can do yoga. You can do classes. We did nothing. We sat and did nothing. And I'm like normally the type that's like always on the go. And I just needed to just chill out and read magazines. We got a massage. It was fantastic.
Beautiful.
She's one of those that you can have a good conversation with.
Nice.
I didn't stop talking. I feel like if it were my husband, he'd be like, okay, Kelly, I need to, he put on his Bose headphones, be like, okay, I'm zoning out now. But we just were talking the whole time. It was great.
Oh, how lovely.
It was
really fun. Yeah, you look all refreshed. And
yeah, I did. It really helped me. And it just kind of reminded me I really need those. I can feel guilty. I feel bad. I'm leaving. And, oh my God, I feel so bad for my kids. And then it's I come back a better mom.
For sure.
So,
absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, I know they used to say that it was quality time and didn't matter about quantity. And then they said, no, that's not true. Quantity does matter.
Yeah.
But to a point, right?
Yes.
I mean, you definitely need breaks and definitely need to take time away, because otherwise you don't want to end up with post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yes.
Which I understand. I listened to the show last week and it was, really great. That woman was so interesting about her story and writing. Why don't you recap a little since you had done the show?
So this is my dear friend, a producer and filmmaker, Abigail Sharon, and she wrote the documentary Rudy and Neil Go Fishing. So it's a really great film, and I'm not just saying this because I really care for Abigail, but it's a really, really great film. It's about 30 minutes, and it's about this guy, Rudy, who has post-traumatic stress from the war, and he is hooked up with this hairdresser, Neil, who also is like an avid fisherman and kind of created this network of helping PTSD victims go, you know, and his therapy, so to speak, is to take them out fishing. And he really believes that something about the wildlife and just being on the water is really soothing and nourishing. And he's, you know, feels like he can kind of connect with people very easily. And it's just a beautiful story. And it also just kind of teaches you that therapy doesn't always have to be so conventional. And, you know, some people don't like to talk and maybe it's too hard, but, you know, maybe they need other forms of nourishment. And that's what I saw.
Right. And as she was describing too, as an alternative method of distraction and in a way of distracting to keep away from triggers. But I did want to add something in because I, you know, wasn't able to speak to the show last time. But, you know, as a former sufferer of post-traumatic stress disorder from various rapes and other things that occurred in my life, I want people to know that it really, with the right kind of treatment and the right kind of therapy, you actually can get better. Like, I don't have any of the symptoms anymore. I can think about it. I can talk about it. I can actually imagine myself in those scenarios. And actually, I don't have any of the visceral responses anymore. My palms don't sweat. My eyes don't dilate. I don't feel like running.
It's good.
Very, 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 I want to say curable.
Yeah,
okay, but I mean,
great.
I went through every avenue of therapy that you could possibly imagine, including EMDR, eye movement desensitization reprocessing. So, you know, and it took years, and it took diligence, and it took commitment, and it took a willingness to really just really walk through that. I just wanted to make sure that people understand that, you know, if you have been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, you can get better.
That's great.
And if not 100% better, to the point where you can have the memory and not have some elements of anxiety, but so much less so.
That's so good to hear. Yeah, because I think it's true. I think we were kind of giving our listeners that feeling that, it can get better, but it's not possible to be cured completely. But that's great to hear.
And I don't want to say that that's true for all kinds of trauma, because it very, very well may be that somebody who's endured years of war and battle and watching people just annihilated, mutilated, all of those horrible things, it may not be. You know, it may be at best that what you can do is learn how to keep yourself away from triggers. And do these types of things like the fishing therapy, which is awesome.
I love that. I love unconventional therapies in general.
You do.
Yes,
I know you do.
You know I'm all about that. Like, I love, for especially adolescents, like those wild wilderness things. I don't know. There's something about the outside that I think just is very calming. I've read studies about ADHD with kids who, you know, one of the things that they recommend is to be outside. There's something really, really calming, I think, for kids being outside in nature.
And speaking of kids, it's a perfect time to introduce our guest, who we're so excited about. And we actually got to speak to him a few minutes before the show. And I just want to say he has a wonderful voice.
Oh, my God.
People who have soothing, calming voices, I'm so happy when they're in the healing professions. So we are introducing our guest today, Dr. Keith
Seibert,
yes, who he's going to tell us it may actually be Seibert, but
no, it's Seibert.
I know it's Seibert, who wrote the book Baby Care Anywhere. I love that title.
Yeah.
It's so cute. It's so sweet. Baby Care Anywhere, a quick guide to parenting on the go. And he has a co-author, Ben Spitalnik, I think is the way this.
Okay, we'll ask him.
Anyway, he is not joining us today, but we do have Dr. Keith. And welcome, Dr. Keith.
Oh, I'm so glad to be here. Thanks to both of you guys for letting me participate. This is great.
Absolutely. Tell us a little bit about your history. I know that you're a pediatrician and you practice, I think, in Savannah, Georgia.
That's right. I was a military child growing up, so I grew up a little bit everywhere, born in Turkey, in fact, and lived all over the world basically as a young child. Ended up doing most of my education on the East Coast, although I did live outside of Fresno in one of the military bases there for a small period of time. Went to medical school at Emory and residency up at the University of Pennsylvania, and then decided to come back towards where my parents and grandparents had settled in the South and live down on the coast in Georgia, and I'm glad to be down there. I've got two little ones. I've got a 1.5-year-old named Camille and a soon-to-be 4-year-old named Caroline, and they are absolute gems, and they've taught me more than any book learning ever could about children.
Oh my gosh.
Well, I have to ask that. Can you separate sort of being a dad from being a pediatrician? Like, are you able to, you know, kind of worry, but then say, okay, no, wait, hold on. You know, if this were a patient, I'm overreacting. Like, can you separate it?
You know, it is funny, isn't it? So I hope that, I think being a dad probably makes me a better pediatrician. Being a pediatrician, I don't know if it makes me a better dad, because I probably get too analytical. And my wife does a good job of reining me in and telling me to quit analyzing situations.
That's very
so
funny.
I'm sure it has its trade-offs.
Right. Do you ever get, though, overreactive about maybe what would be considered minor symptoms in your kids, and then you get like, oh, it could be this, it could be that?
You know, it's funny. I think what happens is the alternative. I think you get underreactive. You start saying, ah, no big deal. She'll get over it. It's just one more cold. And I really don't like using antibiotics on my patients or my own children unless I really need them, and then you do need them. And so with my own kids, I probably let them linger with their head colds or their congestion for longer than some people might, because I keep knowing that I can always, you know, do something about it or make a change tomorrow if I need to. But it is funny how that filters a little different for your own kids or for your patients, and you want to find a way to converge them so you make the same decisions every time.
Sure. That makes sense.
So how did you get into pediatrics? What prompted you in that direction?
Oh, that's a great question. When I was in medical school, I realized quickly about my personality that I like to see closure. I like to see sort of instant gratification, things fixed and moving on and that sort of thing. And I had a ball in surgery and just realized you don't get to talk to people as much in that field. And my personality just really fit more towards a field in which I get what I think is the best of both. I get to know my patients. I get to learn to drop down to the 2-year-old or the 5-year-old or the 9-year-old level of communication during the day, which is always kind of a joy and a challenge.
Yeah.
And I get to see most problems resolve pretty quickly, you know, and it gives you the emotional energy to handle those few problems that don't resolve quickly or that are more serious or have worse prognoses.
Wow.
So it was a perfect blend for me going through training, and I'm just so glad now, years later, that I picked it. I wouldn't have done anything else. I wouldn't change a thing.
Oh,
that's
so
beautiful. I love it when people have found their niche and they really have passion for it. That's amazing. Your patients are so lucky.
So lucky. Well, you sound so soothing and calming, but I always say when I'm at the pediatrician's office, because my kids are like ripping the paper, like I'm always embarrassed because I feel like the doctor comes in and the room looks like a hurricane had hit it. And I'm just kind of like, you know, looking around. But I always feel like you have probably one of the toughest jobs, in my opinion. It's tough.
Oh, so kind. You know what? It's funny. I guess from my side, I see it the other way. I look at the moms, because the moms are the one who are doing the other 23 hour and 50 minutes of work that day.
Uh-huh.
I'm doing the 10 minutes of work with that child. You know, I'm doing the 15 minutes of work. That's it. And so when I'm done, she's got to carry that on. And if it's a fussy, unhappy baby with a fever, she's the one whose work has just begun. You know, and I get to step out for a second.
Yeah.
And I get to watch as the family goes on to carry the load. And then a couple days later, fortunately, I end up hearing that most of them got better, but they're the ones who are doing the tough job. So mine, hopefully, is just a little bit of guidance and a little bit of direction, and then they do their thing, and hopefully we're both right most of the time.
There you go. Hey, it's curious, because you mentioned that mostly it's the moms. In Georgia, is it still dominantly the moms who come in with the babies, or is there a greater balance with the dads coming in, too?
You know, I think to some extent some of the stereotypes are still maintained, although we do see a lot of job sharing that's improving now.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're seeing better and better mixes, and I realize there's some value judgment implied in that comment, but I do think it's better to see more and more folks involved in the care of kids and the recognition of what they need and what their challenges are. So I'm going to guess and say probably 80-20 moms to dads, but something like that kind of ratio for an office visit's about right.
Yeah. Now, Kelly, in your family situation, does David come to pediatrician?
Rarely,
because he can't because of work.
Yeah, rarely. So it's either me, or if I'm at work or, you know, something and I really can't get out, my nanny's taken them once. So, yeah, I think it's
and that's about right for us. Yeah, my wife or our nanny kind of steps in when we need to fill the void, and that does, I think, create even more that kind of reinforces that stereotype. But it's so great when dads show up. You know, and a lot of times they have lists for moms about exactly what needs to be covered that day, and I think it's adorable, because I know when I go to the vet with one of our dogs, I will invariably forget to ask some question unless my wife has sent me with a list of exactly what needs to be covered.
It's so funny, so that one time I was really sick. And so was my son. So my husband took my son to the pediatrician. I'm like, I want to be there, though. I have some questions. So he Skyped. And so there we were. You know, here I am looking miserable because I'm sick in bed. But at least, you know, I got to kind of ask the questions, hear what the doctor said. So it was kind of a nice way to to be there, so to speak.
That's great. No, that's wonderful. Every now and then we'll actually be able to contact through cell phones to a deployed family member in the military somewhere. Every now and then I get to get a dad from Afghanistan or a mom from Afghanistan or Iraq who gets to plug into the visit. And it's just wonderful to be able to use technology to connect the family a little bit.
Yes.
Yeah, it's really pleasing to me to know that there are so many more dads who are much more interested now in, even if they can't go because of work or other responsibilities. I always love it when I work with my couples, and I know that both of them make every effort they can to participate in those things. It's got to be a good position for you, too, as a pediatrician. It must feel good to have both parents when you can be interactive.
Absolutely. And it's kind of fun, too, because you realize you stumble upon little bits of disagreement between the parents when you provide advice, whether it's about feeding or sleeping or something else, and you'll see one of them will look at the other with a little grin, and you know you just stepped in the middle of a little debate between them and picked a side. That's kind of comical, but it's great because you get to bring it out and just talk about why, you know, advice or guidance might go one direction. And every kid's different, too, so then you can kind of step back and say, how does this kid respond to what might be a typical word of advice for a situation.
Wow. So you wrote this fabulous book, Baby Care Anywhere, A Quick Guide to Parenting on the Go. This is Dr. Keith who's with us. By the way, if you have any questions for us or for Dr. Keith, you can call us anytime at 323-203-0815. Again, 323-203-0815. Dr. Keith is here. He can answer your questions about pediatrics. But what compelled you to write the book, and how did you meet your co-writer, Dr. Ben?
So Dr. Ben and I work for competing practices. Anytime somebody who asks where we work, we always say that the other one works for the second best practice in town.
Cute.
And so Ben and I have been working on projects for a few things, some medical device development, some working with different organizations in town, and right now are working in some education capacities around Savannah. And one of the requests we had was to help compile some of our advice in a usable format. And as we started to work on that, we realized we're saying the same things to patients all day long. We don't have, at this point, a compendium, a place to put all these thoughts down together and just hand them out so people don't have to feel rushed in an office visit to ask these questions. And so as we looked at these things and realized that this series of questions was so common and important and so foundational for the experience of parenthood that we might be able to put it to one of the national editors and see if they saw a hole in their lineup for a different kind of children's book. And they did, and we were so grateful that they picked that up, and we were published last month. I guess the early July, and we're just so glad to get one more platform for trying to demystify some of the questions of parenthood. You know, we want to make it as easy as it can be. There's enough sleepless nights, and there's enough confusion, competing advice, that to the extent that we can kind of bring it down to a conversational level that an intelligent thinking parent would want to put together in their mind and come up with a story or a narrative on how to take care of kids, we thought we might be able to contribute to that discussion.
Well, it's funny. I just imagine all those really overprotective parents that are asking you a million questions that you probably don't have time to answer. So it's also like a good sort of reference, like, you know, hey, I'm happy to kind of follow up, but here's basically all the answers that you want to know, you know?
Yeah, you know, it is fun because it is very true that a lot of times these questions, when a family comes in with lots of questions, they are questions that will be repeated as that day goes on, and it's unusual to get something truly out of the blue. And, you know, a lot of the questions come down to things like travel, which is something we may talk about a little bit later on, but a lot of these questions where you don't know quite what you do to keep your kids safe as you try to travel in a world that's increasingly busy and hectic. And then, of course, I think nutrition and sleep are the foundation of all health. So getting the opportunity to contribute a little bit to those discussions as well is just a wonderful place to be. And again, we're grateful for it.
Sleep. Oh, my gosh. I am so intrigued by what is your current thinking about babies in their own beds and the family bed, sleeping, how to get them to sleep, self-soothing, yada, yada. I'll go on forever, but go ahead if you can just dive into something.
That's great. So this is one of those times where you get modern data, and the data is pretty clear that an infant sleeping on their back in their own bed without any assistive blankets or pillows or other things around has the lowest rate of SIDS.
Okay.
And the challenge is that that's not always the choices families make when they're sleep deprived and when they're exhausted and when they're in the middle of breastfeeding every hour through the night. And so part of our goal is to, you know, on one hand, say what is currently known about the safest place to see your baby sleep and the safest ways to help them sleep well. And then also to talk about, you know, what are the things to watch out for? What risks exist? And then potentially what options do you have, whether it's with co-sleepers or other devices intended to try to keep your baby safe as you try to get through those first few extremely sleepless weeks? You know, some of the challenge, too, is about setting expectations. We'll see people who have heard that if they use rice cereal or formula, they might be able to force sleep, you know, longer or sleep through the night. And then trying to talk about what's really expected for a baby at various ages, you know, what kind of sleep you should expect and what kind of nutrition should factor into those discussions. It's really a challenging spot. A lot of families find themselves, and I get people asking me about, like you said, whether it's co-sleeping or whether it's use of different swaddling devices. And, you know, on one hand, you answer a question with data, and on the other hand, you answer with the understanding that I think comes from having gone through sleepless nights at home. You know, everyone's trying to do the best thing for their family and their children, and sometimes that's a difficult decision.
Well, it's funny you said, like, you know, sleep for the first few weeks. I feel like mine's 6 and 3, and I'm still having sleep issues, you know, still at moments. I feel like it's kind of a lifelong thing, I feel like, for a lot of us. It's tough.
It, you know, and I don't want to minimize it because you're right. And in fact, you know, on the one hand, you've got this specific issue of SIDS for young infants. And the big challenge there is that although those incidences are rare, those events are rare and increasingly rare since babies were placed on their back to sleep, they're so tragic when they happen that they really fire a lot of emotion on making the right decision sleep for babies. And then, as you said, when you get to 3 and 6, SIDS is, you know, long since off the table. And then you come down to these questions of, well, you know, have communities co-slept for thousands of years? And many have, you know, and then how does that affect the modern lifestyle where you now have often, you know, both parents up and working and the child off to school? And how does disrupted sleep during the night, because although co-sleeping may present an easier opportunity to fall asleep, sometimes there's kicking and random bumping around in the middle of the night that makes it even harder. And what's the effect of that on learning in school and things the next day?
It's a really good point. Right. Like, the parents think they're doing well. It's like, oh, you know, hey, I'll have them sleep. But you're right. It's like oftentimes the children aren't sleeping great either in the parents' bed.
Oh, it's so challenging. So challenging, you know, and it's one of those times where I think the most important thing you can do is find a healthcare person who you can talk to, you know, who's willing to at least acknowledge that there's challenges, you know, and that sometimes there is clear data on what the best option is, but then at the same time, how to get through some of the challenges when it's hard to implement the best practices like that.
I think one of the most profound, simplest statements that my daughter's pediatrician said to me as a, you know, new mom that was, you know, this was many years ago, my daughter's already 22, but when, you know, she was first born, he just said to me, he said, am I doing this right? Am I doing it wrong? And he says, you cannot spoil an infant. You just cannot spoil an infant. And it was so comforting that
isn't that great?
All the indulgence, you know, whatever I was going to do was going to be okay.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm sorry to interrupt because I do get excited and passionate about that. You're right. In those first few months of life, babies have very few, if any, self-soothing skills.
Yep.
You know, they can't intentionally reach out and grab the stuffed animal or the pacifier, suck their finger, suck their ear or their toes or grab their ears or whatever they're trying to do. And it's always hard to see when a family has sort of misinterpreted that tough love or cry it out sort of advice to a little person. Because when they're 6 weeks old and they're crying, they have no way of soothing that or calming that emotion.
Sure.
It's so important to recognize that one of those things we can do as a parent is pick them up and love on them.
Yeah. Oh, I'm so glad you're saying that, because I know there's been so many other experts out there that say, you know, let them cry, let them cry, let them cry. Like, okay, maybe at a certain point in their lives, but not when they're such little dependent little beings.
Yeah.
Yeah, those first few months especially, you know, and then there's some evidence that as you get to that 4 to 6 month range, kids are a little more capable just as their brain starts to take over and they've got coordination and they can use their hands to grab things and grab their toes and twirl their hair. And, you know, they can learn to self-soothe a little bit. But I agree with you, you know, you want to be cautious about just kind of letting that baby go on a a long crying run, it's hard to know if you're really doing any benefit. And with the youngest ones, I think it's pretty clear that you're not, you know. Sure. So like you said, love on them. You can't spoil the newborns, you know, the first few couple months especially.
And so while you can't see this, Kelly is sitting across from me twirling her hair.
So I'm really self-soothing mechanism.
But
it's true.
That's great.
Wait, I have a question because both of my kids had colic, and I'd love for listeners out there who are struggling with it. I mean, it is probably one of the most difficult things I've ever had to deal with. So I'd love for you to kind of give our listeners an idea of what colic is and the best way to treat it.
Oh, sure. I'd be happy to. You know, and that's another point of confusion that we address frequently. Crying babies cry for a lot of different reasons. And some of those reasons are problems that you can actually address and do something about. And some of them, when we define colic, we define it specifically as a situation in which a crying baby is difficult to console, and the pattern of that fussiness takes on a real kind of classic pattern or timing. Basically, we see evening crying that usually peaks between the ages of about 4 and 10. And there's some specific markers of exactly how many hours per day and how many days per week, but really it's the big picture pattern. It's that tendency to have a reasonably happy morning baby who just sort of disintegrates as the day goes on, and by evening you just get to these periods of time where you look at your partner and you're looking at this baby saying, what else can we do? Nothing seems to work. This baby's just crying and nobody can seem to help her. It's just a challenge in that circumstance, although there are some things you can do, and I'll mention that. The first step is to be sure it is actually colic, because when you see a baby who's got a milk protein allergy or an acid reflux or a problem with a ear infection or a respiratory virus or an intestinal virus or a skin condition, many times those often produce discomfort and crying. Those are going on. You'd hate to say, oh, it's colic, and then to proceed down that path without doing something that may be more successful in alleviating an underlying condition. But once you've decided that, and usually we recommend you find a provider you really enjoy seeing and talking to who can help weed through some of those challenges. Once you've decided it is colic, there are a few things you can do. And the first one is that we know that breastfeeding does reduce the rate of colic and the severity of colic, but it doesn't eliminate it. There's plenty of breastfed babies who are, in fact, colicky. The next thing you can do if you are giving formulas, you can use what's called a hydrolyzed formula, or a formula that's been broken down so the complex proteins that may be challenging to digest are not as much of a challenge for that baby. There are a few substances which have been anecdotally used, and there are things like simethicone, which is an oily substance intended to make air bubbles or gas bubbles smaller in size by reducing their surface tension, or gripe water, which is an herbal supplement that's sometimes used to help. And generally, those substances do seem to give relief to some babies, but don't seem to give relief across the board, and are things that we just encourage you to talk to your provider about benefits or downsides or the hope that you're not accidentally putting a lot of foreign substances into your baby without some really good oversight and how to stay safe and provide some relief. And probably the most important thing to know about colic is that it resolves. You know, and as hard as those nights are at 5 weeks and 6 weeks and 7 weeks old, it's nice to know looking ahead that by 10, 11, 12, a lot of the intensity has cooled off. And by 3 and 4 and 5 months, all of a sudden, the baby's ability to both digest food properly and to self-soothe is improved enough that life is a little bit easier for everybody.
Yeah.
How long did it go on for you, Kelly?
Oh, it was so hard. Like, you're bringing me back, and I'm like, I have PTSD from thinking about
that. Oh, my goodness.
I mean, it honestly, like, I feel like I should create a support group for parents who've got colic because it's a different experience. Like, I felt like I'd be carrying my baby around, and I'd be, like, sweating. He'd be crying. I'd be, like, you know, trying to soothe. And like my other friends whose babies didn't have colic, you know, they were just, you know, drinking their Starbucks coffee, relaxing. And it was just like, it was very difficult. And I felt like, I just felt very isolated because I felt
well,
like
and I don't want to minimize that at all. I think the effects on parents are pretty dramatic, especially if it's a first-time parent, because a lot of times they internalize that fussiness as a sign that they're not doing something right or that they're inadequate in their ability to soothe or feed or calm their baby. And that's one of the things we like to address right up front. It's the baby. It's not the mom or the dad.
Right.
You know, and it's one of the reasons you want to be real clear on what you're dealing with. So when you're sure it's colic, you know that it really is something that is a developmental part of life and not a fault or a flaw in parenting.
That's smart. That I'm glad you said that. Yeah, I agree. I mean, I remember my firstborn, I remember 6 months I finally felt some relief, but he also had reflux. And I think maybe at that point, you know, the reflux was dying down as well. But and then
it's so tough to tell. In fact, you're right. A lot of times when you see a fussy and spitty baby, if you treat their reflux but their crying continues, it's always hard to know if you treated part of the reflux but the colic, which is not, by definition, colic should not improve on reflux medicines.
Right.
Because if it does, it's not colic, it's reflux. Right. So you're right. As you look at those complex mixed situations, they can be just such a challenge, so exhausting and so uncomfortable for babies and families.
Well, and Kelly, you had gone through such a scary delivery. I mean, oh my gosh,
horrible.
As you mentioned last week, that David even had some PTSD as a result of that. So, you know, you were already starting without both feet on the ground and having to deal
really
with that.
Tough.
I remember how
I'm so sorry to hear that. You're right. If you're already starting from a point of exhaustion, it's even harder to generate those resources to handle that situation.
Sure. Well, I think also with colic, I feel like I kind of wish that my doctor had sort of warned me, like a, you know, my OB had kind of said, okay, this is a possibility. This is what it looks like. Because I think when you're a first, you know, time mom and you're seeing a baby crying all the time, you don't know, is this normal? You know, I remember, you know, I went to one pediatrician who said, yeah, babies cry. This is what happens. I mean, totally blew me off. And I, you know, she kind of looked at me like, oh, I'm the, you know, overreacting parent, you know. Mm-hmm. And then I went to a GI doctor specifically. And I said to her, you know, here he is screaming. So I'm like trying to scream above him to ask her the question, like, is this normal? You know, and she's like, no, this is not normal. And it was kind of the first time I felt validated, like, oh my God, this isn't normal. And it's hard to tell, you know, you don't know. So I think that's the tough part.
Oh, absolutely.
Too.
And I'm so glad you found someone. And in fact, that's probably one of the most important things to talk about, is how critical it is to find someone whose communication style makes sense for you. You know, everybody processes problems and stress differently. Some people are very, you know, clinical and analytical, and some people step back and are more humanistic about how they handle that. And it's so important to find somebody who processes like you do so they can communicate about that.
Sure.
That was one of the questions we were going to ask you, is what do you do when you're out searching for a pediatrician, aside from those things which are so important, communication styles and feeling like a good fit? Are there any specifics that you would also recommend, like a checklist of things that people should look out for?
Absolutely. So we do have a chapter in the book devoted to that, because it is such a challenge. In fact, we even have friends and family members who ask us that same sort of question, because it's an alliance or a partnership that you really want to have worked out from moment one. So usually our friends are people who we like and who are like us, who basically think and look at the world similarly. So there's really no better resource than your friends who have children, because they can give you some of the more practical insight into how a practice works and how a provider thinks. And of course, you can always find someone with a negative experience no matter where they go. So getting two or three words of advice is really probably the best way to go. And then accompany that friend to the doctor. If you've got time, if you're pregnant and you're thinking about who your pediatrician's going to be, go with your friend when she goes for a baby checkup for one of her children. So you watch, how does the waiting room experience, how does the nurse treat me, how does the physician treat me, how does the physician specifically handle questions? Do they make eye contact? Are they stuck into their EMR, their computer all day, which is something we're all struggling with, understanding how to use technology? You know, do they actually take time to answer questions, and do they address things, or do they have a tendency to refer you back to written materials instead of specifically talking in the room while you're there?
Sure.
And that experience is probably the single best one for figuring out who the right pediatrician should be for you and for your baby.
That's nice.
What would a new parent expect for the first couple pediatric visits in terms of time spent with the pediatrician? Like, I always get nervous when I even just go to my doctor, like, oh, I have too many questions. I want to take up too much time. The insurance isn't going to cover the visit to make it, you know, and I'm worried about things like this. I don't like to take, you know, I don't like to be an overly needy or entitled person, but I also would like to think that if there's a reasonable expectation that pediatricians have, that their new patients are going to come in and just be anxious and wants extra time.
Absolutely. So there's a lot of different ways that physicians in general, but pediatricians in particular, handle that question. So generally, if you're calling in for what is sort of loosely defined as a sick visit or an unscheduled visit for a follow-up, because things don't seem to be right, because you noticed a rash or because mm-hmm. your baby didn't eat well for a couple of days or because there's some issue that you're concerned about, you're worried about a new onset symptom, usually those visits are scheduled for 10 to 15 minutes. And when you come in for a visit like that, it's best, and this is something that a lot of parents apologize about and I always thank them for, is just to write a quick list of the top three or four things to accomplish, because you want to make sure before you leave that you hit those key accomplishments. Now, you might have, you know, at the end of a nice productive discussion about that, you may realize you forgot to ask something about the third toenail on the left foot that looked like it was turned up a little bit, you know, yeah. And if that one happens to get missed that day, no big deal. And if you get especially into a real deep conversation about reflux or colic or whatever else, you might find that 15 minutes or 20 minutes into the discussion that you may not be able to hit some of the smaller things, but you want to be sure that those top few issues are really addressed every single time. And then that's different than a well check. And a well check is usually pre-scheduled in advance. It's usually part of the provider's schedule or the physician's schedule that actually gives enough time specifically to account for both a physical exam and then a review of development and growth. And those visits are usually thought to be longer. It kind of depends on the office, but 15 to 20 minutes is more common, and some people are even at the 25 or 30-minute range. But 15 to 20 minutes, I'd say, would be a standard sort of well-checked duration for a baby.
Yeah, I just want to remind our listeners, you're listening to Dr. Deborah and Coach Kelly, and we have a special guest, Dr. Keith Seibert, who's the author of Baby Care Anywhere, A Quick Guide to Parenting on the Go. If you happen to have a question, please call in at 323-203-0815. And, of course, we always like your emails. Fascinating stuff. Thank you, Kelly. We're going to ask a question.
I was going to remind our listeners as well. I guess we were on the same page. But I do have a million questions, as always.
Of course you.
So, Dr. Keith, I'd like to know, I mean, I remember feeling really overwhelmed with this. What items should a parent have when bringing home their baby for the first time?
That's a great question, and probably one of those things that you can actually do to prepare, which is sometimes it feels like you can't do much to prepare for your newborn. You know, you're trying to get the nursery ready, and then you just wonder what kind of surprises you'll be left with. So go into the store and picking up issues or items, specifically like a baby monitor mm-hmm. and a breast pump. Clothes and diapers.
Okay.
Bathing gear. So usually things like soaps and lotions and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And strollers.
Okay.
And swaddle blankets. And that short list usually does great. The only thing I'd add to that, and we'll talk about each item in just a minute, but the only thing I'd add to that would be like a starter kit. Sometimes you'll see something that has, or a kit that has a small collection of things like fingernail clips or fingernail files, mm-hmm. perhaps a small bottle of acetaminophen, mm-hmm. or a baby shampoo or a lotion or Band-Aids or things like that. And it's kind of nice to have all those in one spot.
Hold on, I encourage you again
to do a little bit of reading. Our book has some advice on this. There's a lot of good references, but things like which monitor do you pick? Do you get the fancy video monitor where you can see every moment of the action in the bedroom? That's a challenging one, because if you see that, you know, sometimes you'll drive yourself crazy at nighttime looking at the monitor screen in the dark saying, wait a second, is she breathing? You know, and you're looking, you can't quite tell, and you run up, and the first night you're in there five times at night just double-checking to see if that happens.
Yeah.
So sometimes an audio monitor is actually enough, you know. You put it beside the crib next to it. You get to hear basic breath sounds. You get to hear your baby squeaking here and there. Mm-hmm. But you don't drive yourself too crazy. And everybody's own threshold for needing to be involved or needing to be aware is a little bit different.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I have to make it
terrible. Breast pumps are so important. And in fact, I just say, if you're going to breastfeed your baby, you want to start thinking about your resources, whether it's a lactation consultant, whether it's about things like a breast pump or about the various items of clothing, specific bras or breast pads. Mm-hmm. Things you're going to want to have later, and it's good to have prepped for some of that. Again, you're going to get great advice from your friends have gone through that process before. And if your hospital, your birthing center, or your obstetrician's office has a lactation consultancy, I know at our practice here in Savannah, we have a couple of lactation consultants who spend a couple days a week here helping new breastfeeding moms. It's nice to touch base with them first and get some advice. You know, a lot of times they'll tell you, don't drop a lot of money on a particular brand of breast pump until you've talked to us, because sometimes different pumps fit different people, and sometimes it actually helps to try them after you've had your baby before you go ahead and, you know, spend all that money and find that you needed a slightly different fit or a different flange or a different pump.
Yep. Makes sense.
Yeah, strollers are another item, of course, where you've got a million different options there. And how much you travel may factor into that discussion as well, how portable it needs to be. I'll stop there, but if you have any particular questions, let me know about any of those items.
I just have to make a terrible joke. There was one fundamental item that was missing from that list.
I know.
A prescription for Xanax for mom.
Oh, that's so
I know it. You're right. Oh, my gosh. I wish we had something different.
No, I'm but
just,
I thought
had
about
a bottle of brandy. I'm
no,
just kidding.
No, but I thought about something. Car seat. That's something.
Oh,
that,
car seats, of course.
Yes.
And in fact, that even that's a whole chapter devoted just to that. You know, when you're thinking about the particular fits, you're going to see so much good advice. And I'm glad that the auto industry has particular latch attachments to get car seats embedded well in seats. And there's a lot of good advice. And this is something you want to really see in person. So whether you use YouTube from a reputable source or even a local fire department or police department can often help you fit that car seat in your car. The first time you do it, it's kind of surprising to see how snug it needs to be and how to not overdo things. For instance, it's not recommended to use both the latch attachments and a seat belt through the car seat.
Right.
And sometimes that's a surprise. People think more is better, but it sometimes destabilizes how the stresses on the car seat are encountered during a car accident.
So I want to know, I think we should just talk a little bit about immunizations, because I know that's
a huge topic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can you
definitely
speak on that just a little bit?
Absolutely. So you're right. Immunizations have been, I think, on the front of the news since 1998, when Dr. Wakefield presented an article in The Lancet in the UK suggesting that there may be a link between MMR vaccination and autism. And then later on, the discussion or the fear sort of changed, and the fear changed to mercury and aluminum and a lot of other things throughout that. And, you know, the good news, at least from the perspective of trying to keep kids from getting some of these illnesses, because we're seeing a rise in things like pertussis and measles and that sort of thing, the good news 18 years in, or 17 years in, I guess, is that there are now studies from I think over 24 countries around the world now that are pretty reassuring that there's not a link that can be repeated or that can be seen around the world between developmental problems and vaccines. And that should give a lot of parents specifically a lot of reassurance that you're not, you know, doing something that is that seems to be risky for large numbers of kids at all. And in fact, the benefits of avoiding some of the more serious infections are high. But a lot of moms obviously do a lot of good research and reading on these sorts of things and have lots of questions. And I don't know if I can think of a more important situation in which you and your provider need to be able to communicate about risk, about concerns, about stresses, you know, whether it's about the pain of the needle stick, whether it's about the, you know, the stress to the immune system or something like that. You really want to make sure your provider can communicate this well. And it's something we do in our office quite frequently. You know, we use analogies and we use numbers that help us as providers. When I vaccinate my own children at my office, when my partner is my pediatrician or one of my two partners is my pediatrician, when they do those vaccines, I want to know that what I've been telling my patients is the same thing that I'm comfortable believing in my heart when I vaccinate my own little kids. So this is one of those situations where that closeness and that communication is really important. And you can start, usually at about 2 months is when you start vaccinating for the bacterial, big bacterial diseases of childhood, pneumonia, meningitis, and whooping cough, those sorts of things. And within that schedule are opportunities to protect against diseases that are less common, you know, things like polio and diphtheria and tetanus and those sorts of things. Unfortunately, the stress on the immune system is something that gets looked at very heavily. How many proteins are we asking the immune system to learn? You know, when compared to a DTP shot that we might have gotten in the 70s or 80s, fortunately, a series of vaccines, the three vaccines or however they're broken up at the two-month visit, those vaccines at that two-month visit actually have about 1 or 2% as many proteins. It's so nice to see that there's a reason that our kids at 2 months get fewer fevers or they get fewer serious side effects from their vaccines, and it's because there's a lot less in the way of protein antigens, things for babies to learn about. And that's sometimes a real reassuring for people to know, but you want to communicate with somebody who can help explain those sorts of concepts and why the schedule exists like it does, and what kind of schedule you're going to work with on your provider for your baby's vaccines. Yes. That's a great concept and topic. Is there anything specifically on that you guys are most worried about?
Well, mostly what we're going to do for the last couple minutes is pick your brain, Dr. Keith.
Yes.
Coach Kelly is going to be our pseudo caller, and she has a question for you.
Do
you
have a I love it. Good. Pseudo caller is the best. Great.
All right. So it was about August 2nd. He's like 2 3/4. Son had diarrhea a few times throughout the day and then vomited that night. And then continued to have diarrhea for another week and then threw up that night again. So a week later, threw up, continued to have diarrhea for about 15 days. I got a stool sample. Everything was negative. My only concern is, so the diarrhea has stopped for the last 3 days, and then yesterday got it again. My concern is that he looks a little bit pale, and I can always tell when he's going to have it because he kind of loses the color in his face. And so I guess my question to you is, I mean, during that time when he had it initially, my stomach was a little bit off for several days. My mom was nauseous. She was with us at the time. So I have a feeling it was some sort of, you know, stomach virus. But now I'm concerned why it's kind of still going on, and then it stopped and now it's continued again, and sort of what I can do going forward.
Sure. I think that's a great question. And I think there's probably nothing more than gut health in these toddler years that's so important, because it really relates to how their immune system functions and how they feel. So yeah, so in terms of why, there's a couple of good answers. And the specific one's probably going to depend on your little one and how things played out. But number one is that you're talking about an immature intestinal tract that doesn't yet always have a good balance of bacteria and probiotic bacteria and normal enzymes. And those improve as time goes on. Such that by adulthood, we've had so many different germs and bugs that have passed through us that we've created a real robust immune system and a robust natural flora. Mm-hmm. So one of the things is that after a virus comes through, we very often see children's intestinal tracts take a week or two or longer to restore balance, and the use of probiotics and yogurt can definitely help with that balance. Mm-hmm. The second part is that sometimes things we do to keep our kids hydrated, specifically on the order of things like juices or sweeter beverages to try to keep them from getting dehydrated, whether it's ginger ale or something like that, all of the sugars that are in those often exacerbate the diarrhea. So one of the big challenges is not jumping straight to the sports drink that's very sugary or to a particular brand of sweet soda to try to help with that. And you may not have done that anyway, but we certainly encourage you to avoid that in that sort of context. A lot of times, in fact, we see toddlers specifically have the longest recovery period, and there are names, things like chronic diarrhea of toddlerhood, or even just toddler's diarrhea, which is just this description of a recognized fact, and that is that age range, 2 3, once their gut gets knocked out of whack, it does not seem to settle at a happy equilibrium again for a while. Wow. So most people would say focus on thinking of probiotics as an important part of the restoration project there. Okay. Some kids do become transiently lactose intolerant after they've been through an event like that, and if they're drinking much in the way of dairy, if the diarrhea continues, stopping that as the gut heals, so the enzymes in the lining of the gut have time to be restored to balance as well before you try to give something that can be more challenging to digest.
Okay.
But that is a classic challenge, so I certainly hope that does not come back.
Thank you so much. I know we're almost out of time, but really fast, should I be worried about the losing color in the face? Does that have anything?
Great question. So yes, there are a few viruses that can affect things like your blood count or your hemoglobin level.
Okay.
And certainly if you see that persist, I would get your provider, your pediatrician, to take a look at your child and to consider checking to make sure that paleness doesn't reflect a problem with the blood count.
Yeah.
Sometimes, though, even the sense of nausea causes what's called a vagal reaction, in which our blood pressure changes a bit, and that makes any of us turn pale or green when we see something that makes us sick. And if it's short-term and it goes away in a few minutes or less than 30 minutes, usually that's part of the illness and it's okay. It won't cause any long-term problem.
Okay. Great. Thank you so much.
Wow, Dr.
You're
Keith.
Very welcome. So glad to be here. Call me anytime. Happy to help out.
Yeah. Okay. So Baby Care Anywhere, a quick guide to parenting on the go. Where can people find it?
That's you can fortunately find it on Amazon. I believe we are online at Target, and we're online at some of the big box retailers, and certainly glad to have it. Barnes & Noble, I believe, has it as well. So we look forward to helping as many people as we can with that. Thanks for having me on. Thanks for letting me talk about Baby Care Anywhere.
So much. Sure. You are such a gem. Oh my God, I wish I lived in Georgia. Yeah. I would be coming to you.
Oh, well, thanks so much. Well, that's great. Well, I look forward to listening to you guys now that I know about your show. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And we will recommend that book. I know
yes,
I will
me too,
all
for
of
sure.
my new parents. Yeah.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Well, I really appreciate it, Dr. Deborah and Coach Kelly, and certainly glad to help.
Thanks so
awesome.
Much. All right, bye-bye.
Wow, and then next week, he's so great.
He
oh
is
my gosh.
Lovely.
He's
just a lovely
just
guy.
Fantastic. Oh, my God, it's so exciting. Okay, so if you missed any part of the show, you know you'll be able to have it downloaded after a few minutes, right? Okay, and next week we have an amazing guest. You do it. Go ahead.
Oh, my God.
Because this is your find. It was your find.
I am beyond excited. So next week, we have the pregnant man. His name is Thomas Beatty. You may have remembered him. He was on Oprah. He is an American female-to-male transsexual, and he was basically the first man to give birth, and he is just a wonderful, wonderful guy, so we're super excited to have him on.
Super excited, and you're super excited. You have this beautiful new website.
Yes, my new website is therapistkellymiller.com. That's therapistkellymiller.com.
Easy for you to say.
And then you can still find my book, Professor Kelly's Guide to Finding a Husband. How about you?
I'm drdebraonline.com, drdebraonline.com, and all my books and articles and blogs, etc., are there, ripe for the reading.
Perfect.
Okay, thank you so much, everybody, for listening.
Thanks so much.
Kelly, it's so good to see you
I'm
again.
So glad you're back.
See you next week.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.